Their plan was simple. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need. To enforce this plan upon a recalcitrant population, they used the politics of scarcity. And so we ask, how did they use food to get everybody to just get along?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 658th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Quebec City who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello. Nice costume.
Producer Carol Staff.
Hello.
Stafford.
Hello.
I got it there sooner or later. Folks, philosopher George Santayana said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Lest we repeat the past, let's look back today and remember how Joseph Stalin and friends used food as a weapon to force a population of recalcitrant city people into submission. And while we're at it, why don't we go ahead and ask as well, could the politics of scarcity be used again? Tough question. Here to help us remember what took place at the formation of modern Russia, we have Mauricio Barrero, who is a professor of history at St. John's University in New York City, also the author of Hungry Moscow, Scarcity and Urban Society in the Russian Civil War. Welcome to the Food Chain, Mauricio.
Hi, Michael. It's nice to be here.
Good to have you aboard. So I have to ask you, how did you become fascinated with Russian history?
I had a good class in college. It's probably just as simple as that. I had a good professor, and it just seemed like a topic that I wanted to continue.
Funny how that works. You get one good teacher, and they send you off in directions you never would have suspected.
Next thing you know, it's 6-8 years later, and you have a PhD in Russian history.
Well, I'm glad that you got that PhD in Russian history, because today we are looking forward to having a great conversation with you about a period of great transition in Russia from the emperor to a chairman, right?
Yes. 4 or 5 decades of great change, traumatic change.
Huge change. So let's tell the people what years we're talking about here.
Well, basically, what I've been studying is the period from the 1917 revolutions till the Second World War, which for the Soviet Union began in 1941. So 1917 to 1941.
And that was a period of great change from the Tsar of Russia to the chairman of the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics, right?
Certainly, yes.
And a period of huge change. So, in your writings, you break this period down into three chunks of different kinds of things, activities. The first would be the revolution itself.
Sure. The first period would probably be that, and then the civil war that is part of that same process. So probably 1917 to 1921 is one distinct period.
That, of course, was a period of great a lot of activity. Overthrowing the Tsar and establishing a new country, and all kinds of things were happening there. A revolution.
Two revolutions, one civil war, foreign troops invade Russia, although, that wasn't a big part of it. But in some ways, just a complete social breakdown. Society falls apart, and the Bolsheviks have to put it back together by force in some ways. But, right. Yes, complete social breakdown.
And then the next period you called the New Economic Plan. What was the New Economic
Economic Policy was a plan by the Bolsheviks that was seen at the time as kind of a step backward from their attempts to bring about communism. So it's a mixed economy. There is some room for private trade.
So the original aim was to completely revert to communism and total control of the central government.
As soon as possible, yeah, certainly.
And then they realized it wasn't going to quite work, so they allowed some free enterprise back into the system. And
sure.
You talk about this period of the new economic policy as being a period of relative calm in this tumultuous period.
Yes, it is. Partly because the period right before it had been so difficult, and we should go back to the First World War, because
right.
that begins in 1914. So the period up of the 1920s was for many kind of a welcome respite from what had just come, you know, before.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the late 1920s, there is no precise date, but, you know, by 1927, 28, you start to see Stalin, who by then has begun to consolidate his power, begin kind of a new push towards what the communist party members wanted, you know, and they had felt that the period of the new economic policy had been one of stepping away from what they had fought for earlier.
Right. So Stalin initiated a period of great collectivization, in which the government essentially took charge of everything, and away we go from here. Let me step back a little bit, Professor, and ask a little bit about history of Russian agriculture, because I understood it to be a country of great productivity, especially with respect to grains.
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly Russia by the late 19th century becomes a big exporter of grain, but
mm-hmm.
At the same time, we need to keep in mind that you have serfdom up in Russia until the mid 19th century, up 1861, and so in some ways after 1861, you have two. Economy side by side. One is commercialized or is turning towards the commercial production of grain, but the other one, the peasant economy, still is more of a subsistence
economy. Right? Okay.
And then the first economy falls apart during World War One. The subsistence one continues, mm-hmm. but the commercialized one falls apart, and then, you know, after 1917, it just does not exist anymore.
Okay, good. Fair enough. The revolution, why did the Bolsheviks take over everything? What were their objectives, for those of us who forgot and didn't really study it? What were they trying to do when they took over the chaos? What was their objective?
Well, I think their objective was clear to as committed Marxists, they felt that a communist society would be more fair, and that that's what the people wanted. And we should keep in mind that up during 1917, the Bolsheviks are quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
They will lose this popular support
as time goes on, but
when
things
on,
when
but
things started, that they, what they were saying is that we're going to make things fair for everybody, right?
And they have a very simple slogan, which is land, peace, and bread, which speaks to the three major groups of the population at the time.
So, land, peace, and bread being we will give you the land, we'll give you the peace, and we'll give you the bread, too.
The bread, right.
Right.
Up to the peasants, the soldiers, and to
and
the workers.
So to the lower strata of Soviet society,
right.
Or Russian society, this
their
is...
Their constituency.
Yeah, their constituency. This is, hey, the promise of the promised land is coming because... The communists are coming, and the communists are going to take care of us. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about how food and the politics of scarcity were used to essentially mold a new nation in the period of between 1917, 1929, 1930 or so. With us today we have Professor Mauricio Guerrero, who's a professor of history, Russian history, at the St. John's University in New York City, also the author of Hungry Moscow, Scarcity and Urban Society in the Russian Civil War. And you got questions? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That was the plan, and they to make it the plan a reality, they used food, and they used the politics of scarcity. Talking with Professor Mauricio Guerrero, who is a professor of Russian history, St. John's University, New York City. Professor, got a question that just came in, and that was, why did the Russians look to something new and untested when there was this great model of success here in the United States? I mean, the United States was booming with activity. Why didn't they emulate the United States instead of something new and untried and untested?
Well, I think that part of the answer to that question has to go back to that socialism had a much longer legacy in the a Russian political discourse, and I think there's the feeling that by 1917 that capitalism has been tried, even though we would disagree that, you know, to the extent that it was tried, but and that it had failed.
And they also pointed to capitalists also as being one of the great villains, did they not?
Yes, they did, and they...
I mean, they were the ones who were exploiting all the grains and making the profits while everybody else went hungry.
Right, and there was some truth to that, because the Russian government in the 1890s exports quite a lot of grain.
Right.
But at the cost to the peasants. Who are taxed more and are left with less food.
Sure. So the peasant, instead of feeding the peasants, they use the grain as a means of foreign exchange.
Exactly.
To buy whatever it was that they needed to buy on the foreign exchange markets, right?
Exactly.
Guns and tanks, probably, most likely.
You know, but also to fund factories and
right.
you know, build new factories, which they did try to do in the late Tsarist period.
Mm-hmm. So when the Bolsheviks took over, then there was kind of a popular sentiment behind them. Yay, these guys are going to take care of us, right?
There's a popular sentiment for what was called Soviet power, and Soviet was not necessarily Bolshevik. Soviet was more the idea.
What does Soviet mean?
Well, in Russian, it means council, but in the context of that time, it meant workers' councils, which were sort of examples of self-government. And the Bolsheviks were one big part of them, but there were other socialist parties. But what happens during the Civil War is that the Bolsheviks gradually they gradually present themselves as being the same as the Soviets, and ban all the other socialist parties. So there is support for this this sort of worker power, but it's not always Bolshevik support.
Right. Okay. So how did the government go about consolidating everything? I mean,
well,
that must have been a job, right?
It is quite a job, and certainly between 1917 and 1921, they will not do it very successfully. Mm-hmm. They will claim central control of most aspects of society, but they really don't have the personnel to do it or the support.
Probably the know-how either when it got right.
And the know-how too, sure, yes.
So they just kind of issued an edict saying from now on, henceforth, from this time on, everything's under our control and that's the way it's going to be, but...
Well, but the way that they actually phrase it is that it's not under Bolshevik control,
right?
But it's under Soviet control,
right? Which is to say, the workers control. Under the power of the masses, then,
right? But gradually the Bolshevik Party kind of puts itself as the spokesman,
right,
for the masses.
Yeah. So and then under this we start seeing a period of great food shortages that really have been going on for a long time, right?
Well, the food shortages that bring the Bolsheviks to power, they're certainly much more severe than what had happened before. But there is a context, certainly, of great scarcity for the workers and for the peasant population.
Mm-hmm.
But
what about the World city War people I, then?
With who? I'm sorry.
The city people.
There are shortages which begin to develop with the First World War.
Right.
As
one might suspect, with it, when you're engaged in a full, no holds bar war, you know there. Our experiences or shortages everywhere. It certainly happened here in the United States.
Sure,
well,
yeah. And there are breakdowns in transportation of food from the country to the city, and so there is this perception that there is food in the countryside. It's just a matter of getting it to the city.
Right. So we hear that today, don't we? That there's enough food grown. It's just getting it.
It's just distributing.
Just distributing it around.
Right.
Let's go quickly to the phone, Mauricio, before we have our bottom of the hour break here, and talk with Helen. Helen, welcome to the Food Chain. Michael Olson with Professor Mauricio Guerrero. Go ahead.
Hi. You're asking some questions that I'm very familiar with. My father was born in Siberia in 1914. I'm sorry. My mother was 18.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was a very big wheat farmer. You want to know how they got the food from the farms to the cities?
Uh-huh.
They woke the farmers up in the night with a gun at their head and said, take all this stuff in there and be there in so and so many hours. Whether it's snowing, whether you're sick, whether you're dying, get that in there or else. And they did this to them again and again and again until everything they had was gone. Then they came and burned everything that was left. They took their animals. They they had to escape from Russia into China and then to the United States.
Professor Barrero, how would you respond to that?
That was part of what happened at that time. Certainly, that was a fairly common experience.
Again and again.
As the food shortages become much more
pronounced,
desperate up in the city, the Bolsheviks resort to more violence. And the thing again is also that they don't fully control the whole country. So people are doing things
to get around
in Siberia, for example, that the Bolsheviks in Moscow might not necessarily know about.
Right.
But certainly, as the situation becomes much more desperate, the government resorts to more force.
So, as things become increasingly more desperate in the city, the hungry get they're more and more hungry, and they get hungrier and hungrier and hungrier, and they look to the government and they say, "Help, help!" And the government gets, what are we going to do? So they go out into the countryside where Helen's grandfather was growing wheat, and they flog him and steal his wheat and burn his buildings down, and there we are.
Well, first they do try to establish barter exchanges where they say, you know, if the peasants give us their food, we will give them tools and, you know, things that they need. Those don't always work because of this whole context of breakdown, you know, and then so they might not have enough things to give to the peasants.
Sure. So, okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Right back, Mauricio Guerrero, professor of Russian history, St. John's University. Helen, you going to stick with us for a moment?
I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the call, Helen. Appreciate it.
Okay.
We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need. That was the plan. And it all went well for a little while, I guess. But then people got hungry, especially those people who were in the city. And we're talking, of course, about the great formative period of 1917 to 1930 or so, of the from when Russia went from a czarist country to a Soviet socialist republic. And we're talking about how the politics of scarcity were used to mold that period and mold those people and mold that country. With this, we have Professor Mauricio Borrero from the St. John's University in New York City. Mauricio, where did the city people get their food when they were hungry? Oops, I think I better press the button here. Go ahead.
Once the Bolsheviks gained control and they abolish, at least formally, all private trade, they would get bread, which was the main part of people's diets, through a system of rationing, they established several categories.
Rationing was probably something that had been going on for a long time in Russia, or at least in countries in periods of war, right?
During the war, yes, and so we see it everywhere else. We see it in France. We see it in Germany during the war. So that part's not necessarily new, and the categories that they set up are not new either, in the sense that they feel that the people doing heavy physical labor should get more than the ones who are not, for example. So
did we not have a similar rationing program here in the United States during World War II?
I think we did. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So this is really rationing. Certainly wasn't something out of place. And what you do is you try to get the food to the people who need it, so you can get things done. But this egalitarianism didn't last all that long, did it?
It didn't last all that long, and so they begin with three basic categories. But by the end of the Civil War, there are at least 20 to 30 different categories depending on the work people are doing.
Wow, 20 to 30?
So, and I think that's mostly dictated by the fact that there's just not enough food to go around, and different groups of people are pressing the central government, saying we have factory workers here, you know, producing this good, and they you know need food, and so that begins to come from different parts of the country, so that the government begins to create different categories, exceptions, let's say, to the basic rule, and also there's so little food that they that in some cases they can't give bread every day. They give bread out every third or fourth day. So the context is just one of great need, of great shortage.
Great hunger there. Absolutely.
Great hunger, yes.
Wow. And then, of course, this proceeded, and it became ever more selective, too. And did there come a time when the government used food to reward those who were followers and punish those who were not?
Well, I think the first part probably yes, the Communist Party members gradually will be getting more rations, but not sure that we could say that they withhold food from people to punish them.
It's just by rewarding those who are favorable.
As a reward system. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, but this stops in 1921-22, and then up to the 1920s, we don't have rationing. But then again, it comes up again in the late 1920s, and then during World War II, of course.
Sure. It Stalin reinstitutes the whole notion of collectivization, and he brings, I guess that's when things really fell apart, wasn't it?
Well, for the peasants, yes, because that is when by the late 1920s, after the decade of where they have had land, and they will lose it again, and the state takes over. And in some ways, in some cases, the peasants refer to this period as a period of the second serfdom. That
the collectivization of the farmland, and they revert essentially to becoming
serfs. It's like going back to serfdom.
Yeah, as they were under the czars.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So city people. Under this food rationing, and there was another program too, right? Dining halls.
And then, yes, the feeling was that because of communist theory and ideology, that the family was something of the past, and so we would establish these public dining halls.
To get rid of the family, get rid of the family kitchen table, right?
Not all communists felt that, but that was part of it. And the second part was just that they felt that it was a more efficient way to distribute scarce resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that if they cooked for you know 300, 400 people. They could distribute the food better than if each you know family of four or five is getting food and trying to cook it.
That would be more equitable.
More equitable
and efficient too.
And certainly efficient. Yes.
Okay. And so what happened? Tell us about these dining halls.
Well, they kind of
replaced restaurants, right? Private enterprise.
They do replace restaurants. But again, the quality of the food is not very good, and they face the same problems. Not enough food up to go around. But they do provide just a bit of a safety net. Through the 1920s and on, they will continue to be a part of the Soviet experience in terms of public dining or right. dining in public. There are these public canteens where you know food is very cheap.
Right. So these two ways, the rationing and the dining halls, the public dining halls, are kind of like the welfare of today, right? Or they're kind of designed to serve those who can't take care of themselves otherwise?
Well...
Or were they designed to take care of everybody?
I think the context is very different. The context back then was one of widespread scarcity.
Mm-hmm. So everybody
the
was
context
in
of modern welfare is somewhat different.
Okay, we're going to hold that and pick it up when we come back. I'd like to talk about the unofficial way people got their food in times of great shortage. With Professor Mauricio Borrero, a professor of Russian history, St. John's University, New York. Right back, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. We're talking about the use of food to mold and shape populations. And specifically, we're talking about the Hungry of Moscow during the periods of the early formation of the Soviet Union with Professor Mauricio Borrero, who is the professor of Russian history at St. John's University. Quick question, Mauricio. Rationing was seen by the Bolsheviks or the Soviets or the workers or what have you as a way of supplanting the market, right?
Yes.
And it gave them the opportunity. So instead of people decisions being made by supply and demand, there would be an orderly decision-making process made by the central planners, and they would decide how much of what would go where and who would get how much, right?
That was a theory, yes.
Was that what they tried to do?
I think the rationing as far as food was driven by, first of all, just how to distribute up the food more fairly.
Mm-hmm. The egalitarian.
The second concern, once there it becomes clear that there's just not enough food to go around, is how to distribute it to those who need it more, particularly up the workers who are engaged in things which
sure.
are up for the state, you know, for mm-hmm. Either to you know build factories or you know,
workers,
weapons, if it's the Civil War. So that's when it begins to become more selective in some ways.
Okay, let's go quickly to how we're talking about how hungry city people got their food when there wasn't enough food to get. And, of course, the official way was through the government rationing programs and dining halls. But there was also an unofficial way that consisted of, well, just going out into the country and buying it from the peasants. Or the peasants would come into town and buy it and sell it in farmers' markets, right?
Yeah, the one that was more common was for people from the city to go out up to the countryside. They were called meshochniki, which is from the Russian word for sack, because they would be known by the you know, big sacks that they would take, so they could put the food in there. It's a black market economy, basically, that developed side by side with
and the Russians and the Soviets allowed for this black market.
The Soviets publicly, they you know fight it and say no, that this is not legal, and but they know that through the state system they cannot really provide for all, and so the black market becomes. Kind of like a safety valve.
And one of the biggest black market farmers markets was in Moscow.
In Moscow, the Sukharevka, as it was called, you could find anything there. But obviously, like for example, for food, the price would be 100 times more. You know, 200. You know, 5,000 times more in some cases. In the worst cases,
So somebody was making a lot of money.
The great contradiction is that this exists at the same time that the state is trying to create this
right.
whole network.
It You know,
and someone is making money, yes.
When I was building my book, Metro Farm, I read in the Wall Street Journal about the Moscow farmers market, and my father-in-law was taking a trip to Moscow, so I asked him to take some photographs of that market so I could put it in Metro Farm. And so he went to that market. He had a taxi cab driver take him to the market, and this was still during the period of the Soviet Union. So he went to the market, started walking around the market, taking pictures like a happy tourist, and he has this wonderful video of us panning the market and seeing all of these people buying and selling, and all of a sudden there's a 7-foot-tall security guard comes up and grabs his camera, and you could just see the hand go down on the camera. So they arrested him for taking pictures of the farmer's market during this time. Why was that? Why would they do that? Why would they arrest him?
Well, when was this? 1960s, 70s?
Yeah, late 70s.
I think, you know, back then at that time, the Soviet government was very self-conscious of how foreign people saw it, you know, and what they could see inside of the Soviet Union, even though by then there was much more contact with
the West, yeah,
with foreigners, but even then they were very sensitive.
They certainly were. I could ask my father-in-law about that. Let's go quickly to Nick. Nick, welcome to the food chain.
Yeah, good morning to you, Michael.
Go ahead.
I'm 1/4 Russian, and my grandmother would tell me the story when I was a little boy about her mother and her uncle. And they owned a farm, and I believe it was outside St. Petersburg. They had a farm there. Excuse me. This is during the Bolshevik Revolution. I don't exactly remember the time or remember if I was told the year exactly. But the previous spring, the Bolsheviks had came to the farm, and they had took all their horses except one plow horse and left with basically pretty much what they had.
Quick question.
The next spring they returned. They said we're going to take your last plow horse. Well, my uncle, great uncle, and my great aunt resisted and said, "No, you cannot take that horse. We won't allow it."
Oh, okay, Nick, I got to take a quick break.
Guess
I'm
going
to hold on to you. I'll pick you up when we come back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, we're back, and we're talking about the politics of scarcity, the early period of the formation of the Soviet Union, with Professor Mauricio Barrero, professor of Russian history at St. John's University. Nick, you want to finish your story?
Yeah, real quick. Anyway, of course, they needed that plow horse that spring to, plow the fields, whatever, and they resisted. And they were shot on the spot, the both of them.
Well.
Yeah, that's communism, and as Mao says, you know, power comes out of the barrel of a gun. And that's maybe why they had food shortages.
Professor?
They eliminated any of the farmers who resisted the takeover.
Well, I think what you were describing is what took place later in the 1920s,
especially
1929 collectivization. That's certainly what was a brutal process. What we had been talking about before was a decade earlier when the situation was somewhat different. But you do see some the Bolsheviks beginning to turn to force much more. But the things you described were more a feature of the period between 1929 and 32-33 when the state basically takes over all the farms.
That's when Stalinism really came into being.
That certainly is. And the peasant the peasants who fought back were you know, either shot on the spot or deported to Siberia. And it was a brutal process, and in some ways, Soviet agriculture doesn't get back to its pre-1929 levels in terms of food production till the 1960s or so.
Oh. Let me ask you two really tough questions. We have just a couple minutes left. First of all, did the state protect individuals from the inequalities of the market, or did the market protect individuals from the inefficiencies and incompetence of the state?
I think in this particular context, the market fails first, and so that opens up the path for the state to make the claim that it can protect them. Later on, when the state has been dominant through the 20s and 30s and 40s, I think you could begin to make the argument that the market, which is mostly black market, can make up for the shortcomings of the state distribution system.
Okay, and the last question, but the big one, do you see any indications of the politics of scarcity being used in modern times?
Worldwide or just in Russia? Or
how about United States?
Well, I think United States, I mean, that's such a broad and complex question, but I would say that in terms of food, I think that every society makes a lot of choices in terms of how food is distributed. The market makes choices too. I mean, those who have better access, those who have less money have less access.
Well, Professor, you could be a politician as well as a professor, because that was a pretty good answer. Professor Mauricio Borrero, St. John's University, thank you so much for joining us. Also, he's the author of Hungry Moscow, Scarcity and Urban Society in Russian Civil War. Thank you all for tuning in, and remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.